From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Nutritional science is complicated, to be sure, but here is science writer Gary Taub's answer to the question of why we get fat in a nutshell. It's not because we're consuming too many calories. It's not because we're not getting enough exercise. It's not even that we've got too much fat in our diet, like butter or meat. The reason we get fat, Taub says, is because of carbohydrates. The bad ones, anyway. Refined grains and starches and sugars. Taubes has been making this case for years now, but it's not new. In fact, in his books, he explains how scientists in Europe before World War II had figured this all out. But at some point, the idea emerged that the fat was the problem and that a calorie was just a calorie. Well, Gary Taubes is joining us today to debunk some of those ideas and explain the science of why we get fat after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When you're talking about a person's weight or about the food they eat, things pretty quickly get personal. It's because so much is bound up in these things. It's about our self-image, about our lifestyle, even about our ethics. The science writer Gary Taubes knows this. In his latest book, he says, so many kinds of belief systems enter into this discussion about what really makes up a healthy diet that it often seems more like a religious issue than a scientific one. And Taubes says the moral and sociological considerations are valid. They're worth discussing, he says, but really, they have nothing to do with the science itself. That's what his work has been focused on for the last several years, what the science tells us about why we get fat. And his conclusion can be controversial. It's not because, he says, we're consuming too many calories. It's not because we're not getting enough exercise. It's not that we're eating too much saturated fat. Taub says we get fat because we eat too many carbohydrates. Today in the program, he's joining us to make his case, and we invite you to join us as well. With comments or questions, 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Gary Taub's writing has appeared in Science Magazine, in the journal Nature, the British Medical Journal, and in the New York Times Magazine. He's the author of four books, including Good Calories, Bad Calories. His latest, as I mentioned, is Why We Get Fat and What to Do About It. And he's joining us today from the studios of Youth Radio in Oakland, California. Gary Taubes, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
You've been writing about this for more than a decade now. It began as a series of investigative articles that you were writing for the journal Science, and then the New York Times Magazine also. What did you know or suspect about nutritional science before you started looking into all of this?
I was actually completely naive. I had spent much of my life, my professional life, writing about controversial science, yeah. Good science and bad science in fields beginning with high-energy physics. And then I got directed into public health in the early 90s by some physics friends who said, if you're interested in bad science, you should look at public health research. Hmm. And then I almost literally stumbled into nutrition research at the end of the decade when I unwittingly began an article on the controversy over whether salt causes high blood pressure. And after I had finished this, which effectively 2 years' worth of work for Science that was published in two articles, I was stunned at the level of science that I was dealing with and the level of evidence that was being used to promulgate public health advice and, in fact, to create the dogma, the conventional wisdom that we all believe.
I don't want to be too overly dramatic here, but do you remember, did you have a kind of, epiphany about all of this, some fairly stark realization anyway, that what most of us had believed about getting fat was pretty much just kind of wrong? Did it finally just occur to you that You want to write about this? You need to write about this?
You know, I wanted to write about the science in general.
Yeah.
I actually – it's almost embarrassing to say. Well, I'm happy to say in the show what I think the single greatest error is. What my epiphany should have been it actually came so slowly that afterward, and after I wrote my first book on nutrition, I was kind of stunned that I didn't play it up more. It's this whole idea that you've talked about in the introduction that we get fat merely because we take in more calories than we expend. And like I said, I'm a little embarrassed that it wasn't an epiphany.
I wonder, we're going to jump into the science here, I promise, in a moment, but I did wonder what kind of effect this research had on you, you know, personally, in terms of your own health. Did you ever have weight issues? Was this ever something that added some dimension or texture to the way you were writing about this, is because you kind of felt invested in your own health?
Not really. I was an athlete in college. I was a third-rate football player at a second-rate football school. As I was a lineman, so people of my general body type tend to get fatter as we get older. But I also lived in California in Los Angeles by the beach. So I exercised constantly, as everyone does in L.A. And over the years, I had been gaining a couple pounds a year. And you think it's just fate. You know, if I'm working out an hour a day and I'm still gaining 2 pounds a year, then there's obviously nothing I could do about it. My metabolism slowing down.
Yeah.
And then as I was working on the science article in Dietary Fat in 1999, I was interviewing a freelance journalist. So as us journalists tend to do multiple stories at once to pay the bills.
Yeah.
I was also reporting a story for the magazine Discover on the mathematics of the stock market. And I was up at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, interviewing an economist who runs the laboratory of I can't remember the actual name of his lab, but we got into this discussion of how meticulous you have to be to understand causality in science. And I told him about this article I was writing on dietary fat, and he said, "Well, if you're writing an article on dietary fat, you have to try the Atkins diet as an experiment." He said he has a colleague at Wharton whose father lost 200 pounds on this diet, and this MIT economist is Asian American. He said he had won on it. And he had lost 40 pounds effortlessly, effectively giving up white rice. So I went back to Los Angeles. I did an experiment. This is a diet that's supposed to kill you. You eat, eggs and bacon for breakfast and animal products and green vegetables all day long. And you should get heart disease within 10 minutes. And because you're eating as much as you want and seemingly large amounts of food, and I'm a big guy, I can eat large amounts of food, you're supposed to get fatter, and yet I lost 25 pounds effortlessly. I almost stopped working out because I had been working out to keep my weight under control. Now I didn't see any reason to work that hard to do it. And I have to say, back then I didn't stick with it, but it sort of was – that was kind of an epiphany because it's such a anomalous experience. Everything you – confront when you struggle with your weight, when you're getting hungrier and all the diets you've been on and all, you get hungrier and hungrier and you think of food constantly. And here you change the macronutrient composition of your diet and the weight just goes away and you're not hungry, you eat as much as you want. So that anomaly, what scientists would call an anomalous event, stuck with me throughout my research, definitely.
You say in Why We Get Fat, that the book, that you had some kind of common responses. First, you say it came from researchers who were saying that, you know, the science contained in your first book, Good Calories, Bad Calories, made sense. But then you say it seemed like there was this kind of collective shrugging of people's shoulders, like there was no kind of urgency. I'm wondering, were you frustrated by that? Because it seems like there is a sense of urgency in the way you've been writing about this, and people are saying, okay, that makes sense, but there doesn't seem to be the sort of follow-through. There's like not a kind of a lag time here.
Well, and it's funny. Just this morning, some research friends of mine sent me an article from Swedish researchers at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm who were describing in their article how fat individuals, obese individuals, have what appears to be a delayed inhibition of the process that releases fat from their fat cells. And these researchers had been studying the dynamics of fat cells for decades. And if you believe what they say, their research, then what you want to pay attention to in obesity, and the argument I've been making in my books, is not how much people eat and exercise, but the forces at work to put fat in fat cells and the forces at work, the biological forces at work to get fat out. And I literally wrote to my friend saying, you read these articles, why don't they care that all the public health advice is dependent on an entirely different theory of what causes obesity? So we have this belief system that we get fat merely because we take in more energy than we expend. We either eat too much or we can't eat in moderation and we don't exercise enough. And yet here are these researchers, very high-level researchers, publishing in the very best journals in the world, and their articles are all about how obesity is determined by the enzymes and hormones that regulate accumulation of fat in fat cells. Why don't they care? Why am I out here making this argument that the public health view of this is incorrect, but those researchers aren't out there with me, and I don't know what the answer is. But it's, to me, it's a fundamental problem.
Is it a cultural thing? I mean, I mentioned in the introduction there something that you had written in the book about the fact that there are all of these belief systems that come into play for this question. There's ethical stuff and moral stuff and sociological stuff. Is that part of the – would that explain part of the resistance to it?
That's certainly part of it. And this idea, this energy balance idea, calories in, calories out idea, is so deeply ingrained in our thinking. And it's so deeply ingrained in the thinking of the research community that's done it. And I believed it. Mm-hmm. This is the one I should have had an epiphany when to learn that it was nonsensical, but it took me a decade to get there. But this belief system, it just seems so universal, so I mean, I don't even know how to phrase it. It cannot be questioned.
Yeah.
And to question it makes you appear to be a quack. So the research community, they might agree in a conversation. And when I've given lectures on this and I've given grand rounds in hospitals and in medical schools, and I often feel that the lectures have this sort of 36-hour half-life, like the physicians and nurses and researchers will hear what I say and they'll say, this is very thought-provoking, it's very interesting, and it makes a lot of sense. And then within about a day and a half, they've fallen back to the way of thinking that they've been thinking their whole life. And so the challenge is, how do you get people out of this way of thinking about obesity as an energy intake expenditure problem, which is so destructive in so many different levels? And that's what pretty much I've devoted my life to now.
Yeah.
And a lot of colleagues with me.
I suppose part of the problem is that carbohydrate-restricted diets tend to replace, as you put this out in your book, they tend to replace those carbs with animal products, meat and eggs. So how do you respond to those concerns? Because you point out in your book it's okay to debate the implications of all of this.
So, well, this is when I made the switch from when I – so in 1999, 2000, I write this article for Science on the science or lack of science behind our belief that a low-fat diet is healthy.
Yeah.
And then I pitch a story to the New York Times Magazine on what causes the obesity epidemic. And the obesity epidemic was new enough at the time that it seemed it was an interesting story to be able to speculate on what the environmental triggers of this epidemic were. And in the course of my research on that, I come upon five studies that have been published, or they've been finished and discussed in conferences. They haven't been published yet, in which the researchers put the overweight obese subjects on two different diets. One is a carbohydrate-restricted diet where you replace carbohydrates with fat, and it's a lot of saturated fat. And the other is an American Heart Association low-fat, calorie-restricted diet, the kind of diet that we're used to sort of starving ourselves on for the past 20 years, where we're eating for lunch, a little ice cream scoop size of tuna fish with some lettuce. And they run these studies out, and lo and behold, not only the people on this Atkins-like low-carb, high-fat diet lose more weight despite the fact that they could eat as much as they want, their heart disease risk factors in every single study improve compared to the ones on the diet the American Heart Association is telling us to eat. So here's another instance where the data actually supports. So there were five studies when I wrote my New York Times Magazine article. There's probably 20 or 30 such studies a decade later today. They're all consistent. And constantly you see this improvement in heart disease risk factors, this improvement in risk factors for diabetes, this syndrome called metabolic syndrome that 75 million Americans have according to the CDC that predisposes us to heart disease and diabetes, improves on these diets. And yet it still hasn't had much of an impact on the public discourse. So when you actually talk about the foods, there's one mental block where doctors and researchers have been taught to believe that this low-carbohydrate, high-fat diet is quackery, that Robert Atkins was a quack, and if he said something was true, it must be ignored. And then the other issue is a deeper one, which is, again, is how we perceive obesity, whether it's an energy balance issue, too many calories consumed, or whether it's a hormonal defect.
Well, we're going to get to that.
It's a hormonal defect. That explains a lot of the – it explains what obese and overweight people go through their whole lives.
Yeah. I want to work through that science as we go. But one thing that's interesting is you write about the fact that you talking about this is not exactly new. Before World War II, there was a whole community of scientists and physicians who understood this and were doing, as you describe it, this kind of pioneering work about all of this. I wanted you to talk about that.
They understood a part of it.
Yeah.
So prior to World War II, one thing I learned in my book, one thing that was an epiphany in my research was that all the significant scientific research went on in Europe. Science was, in effect, a European invention. And in medicine, all the fields of medicine relevant to obesity were pioneered in Germany and Austria in the, from the 19th century onward. So endocrinology, which is the study of hormones and hormone-related diseases, metabolism, nutrition, genetics, they all came out of Austria and Germany. And these researchers really understood these fields in a way that American researchers and American doctors didn't. And in the U.S., or if you wanted to do serious medical research, you hadn't. The German was a lingua franca of science. So you not only had to read German, but ideally, you spoke it as well so you could go and do a postdoc or a mentorship in Austria, Germany with these Herr Professor doctor types.
Yeah.
And from the 1920s to the 1940s, they had developed this theory that obesity was, in fact, a hormonal defect. And it was based on a lot of observations that told you that hormones play a large role in how fat is accumulated. Like men and women fatten differently. So men tend to fatten above the waist and women fatten below the waist. That tells you that sex hormones are involved. When boys and girls go through puberty, boys, they start off puberty with roughly the same amount of body fat. And then boys gain muscle and lose fat, and the girls gain fat, and they gain fat in very specific places. And there are also instances where patients had had skin grafts from one part of the body to the other. So a case that came up in the early writing was a young girl had a bad burn on the back of her hand, so they grafted skin from her stomach to the back of her hand, and then she grew up and became obese, and she had this huge puff of fat on the back of one hand but not on the other. And so they said, obviously, there are hormonal, enzymatic, central nervous system factors that determine how much fat is accumulated. And just as some people, you know, the hair was a metaphor they used. So just as some people, we grow hair in some places and not in others. We get fat in some places and not in others. And just as some people are hairier than others, some people are fatter than others. But what they couldn't do pre-World War II was understand what hormones and enzymes actually regulated this accumulation of fat in the fat tissue because they didn't have the technology.
Yeah.
And then the war comes, the science is lost, the lingua franca of science switches from German to English. The study of obesity is kind of reinvented at the Harvard School of Public Health by nutritionists, PhDs who don't treat obese patients. They don't see patients at all. They study animal models of obesity. So they have none of that clinical understanding of what obesity looks like in a human being, how fat accumulation might differ from people to person to person, the struggle that obese individuals go through to lose weight. And they kind of embrace this idea that a calorie is a calorie, and it's all about, you know, just sort of how much you eat and how much you exercise. And meanwhile, and a lot of the message in my book is how the specialization of science kind of affected how these fields evolved. Meanwhile, biochemists and physiologists get the tools they need to understand hormonal regulation of fat tissue. And by 1963, it's clear that the hormone insulin, which we think of as a hormone that's defective in diabetes, that hormone insulin regulates, pretty much controls the accumulation of fat in fat cells. And we secrete insulin in response to the carbohydrate content of our diet, primarily in response to the carbohydrate content of our diet. So the argument I make in my books is by the mid-60s, the what scientists would call the null hypothesis of obesity, the simplest possible hypothesis should have been that obesity is a hormonal defect. It's a defect of insulin signaling, just like diabetes is. And type 2 diabetics, of course, tend to be obese, and obese individuals tend to develop type 2 diabetes. So it explains that connection.
Yeah.
And the environmental trigger should be the carbohydrates in our diet. And through the 1960s, a conventional wisdom was that carbohydrates were fattening.
Yeah.
One of my favorite lines that I quote in both my books is for the first sentence of a British Journal of Nutrition article in 1963, written by one of the leading British dietitians, and it was, "Every woman knows that carbohydrates are fattening."
Right.
And then all of this is just thrown out because we get obsessed with this idea that dietary fat causes heart disease, we should eat a low-fat diet, and in a low-fat diet, you replace the fat with carbohydrates. So by the early 1990s, the food guide pyramid of the USDA, the same, very same foods that in the 1960s that my mother's generation thought were uniquely fattening,
yeah,
bread, potatoes, rice, pasta, become the base of the food guide pyramid. The foods were being told to eat, you know, 8 to 11 servings per day because they're low in fat.
You start with this story in the book, in the introduction. This young German pediatrician named Hilde Bruch, she moves to the United States in the early 1930s, and she's seeing a lot of overweight children. And it's interesting you say that people were wondering throughout the world, why are these American children so overweight? And we should remind people, as you do in the book, that this was before fast food. I mean, this is the 1930s. This is before high fructose corn syrup, and it was certainly in the midst of the Depression. But we're already starting to see this. And Hilde Bruch is a really interesting sort of character that you use throughout the book. Talk a little bit about her.
Well, Hilde Bruch was the leading authority on pediatric obesity in the mid-20th century. And as you said, she was a German pediatrician who fled when the Nazis party took over Germany in 1933. She came to the U.S. By 1934, she was in New York, walking around the streets of New York in the heart of the Depression. So this is the 20th century at its single poorest point. And she's walking around thinking, my God, the kids in New York are really fat, not just chubby, roly-poly obese. And she actually, because of that observation, she starts the first pediatric obesity clinic in the United States at Columbia University. And then she goes on to do these pioneering studies on pediatric obesity. And the point I'm making is we blame the obesity epidemic today on the just ready availability of all this calorie-dense food. As you put it, the fast food restaurants, there's a McDonald's or Burger King on every block. The assumption, of course, being that everyone who's obese must eat a McDonald's and Burger King regularly. You know, there's the vending machines and the convenience stores. You just can't walk 30 feet without, you know, being prompted by our environment to eat too much food, and simultaneously we're sedentary. We don't get enough exercise. We stay home and we're on our computers, sitting down all day, watching television. And yet you could find these populations in our history, like the children of New York City in 1934 that Hilde Bruch noticed, that had none of these characteristics of this toxic environment as we would describe it today. No fast food, no vending machines, no computers or video games, not even television. And I list about 12 such populations that you can find in the literature prior to the 1980s. And yet they have these very high levels of obesity. They experienced obesity epidemics. And one of the things you can do in science is you can use these to say, well, what did these populations have in common with what our population has in common? And what they had were recent increases in the amount of refined flour and sugar they were consuming. You know, by the 1920s, the sugar consumption in the United States skyrocketed with the Industrial Revolution, as it did in many places in the world. So you get the birth of the soft drink industry and Coke and Pepsi and the confectionery industry and the dried cereal industry. And by the 1920s, actually diabetes rates in the U.S. had also increased. In some cities, diabetes mortality had increased 15-fold. Between the late 19th and the early 20th century. So diabetes, there was an epidemic back then, and what was new was the sugar and refined flour. And then what you find in the U.S. in the late 20th century is suddenly we're promoting diets high in refined grains, high in starches, simultaneous with an increase in the consumption of sugars with the addition of high fructose corn syrup to our diets. So you see the same phenomenon. You have a biological underpinning to explain it.
Gary Taubes is with us. His new book, well, he's got a number of books about on this issue. I mentioned Good Calories, Bad Calories. The latest, anyway, is Why We Get Fat and What to Do About It. And you can join us if you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you're trying to lose weight, a lot of us figure we need to deal with that energy imbalance, burn more calories than we consume, calories in, calories out. Well, the journalist Gary Taubes says that's not how it works. And for years now, he's been writing about nutritional science, and he says the problem isn't calories and it's not the fat in food, despite what we've been hearing for decades now. The problem, he says, is carbohydrates. His book is called Why We Get Fat and What to Do About It, and we invite you to join us, 801-585-WEST, the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So I want to say a little bit more about the science of hormones. You say there are essentially two factors going on that determine how much fat we accumulate, and they're both related to this hormone, insulin. Explain the first. When insulin levels are elevated, we accumulate fat in our fat tissue, and when they fall, we get rid of fat tissue, I guess. Is that essentially how it works?
They're pretty close. I mean, there are a lot of variables, a lot of factors that determine fat storage, but the primary one is this hormone insulin. That's the one that connects that's fat stored in fat cells directly to our diet and what we eat and how much we eat. So, yeah, and when you consume a diet with carbohydrates in it, those carbohydrates get into your bloodstream and they begin to raise blood sugar. And actually in preparation for this, your body's already secreting insulin from the pancreas. And then the insulin continues to go up. And what it does is it basically signals cells, you know, the muscle cells, to take up the glucose, the carbohydrates, and burn it for fuel. And they facilitate the flow of glucose into these cells so they could do a better job of burning it. But while they're doing that, they're telling the fat tissue to hold on to fat and store it. So it's a, you can think of it as a control system that in this instance is being used to make sure that we burn, that blood sugar doesn't get too high and that we keep blood sugar under control, because high blood sugar is toxic to the body. And in doing so, it just, when it's working effectively, it just says, look, let's hold on to fat in our fat cells. And insulin has this effect on the fat cells in many different ways. It upregulates enzymes that pull fat into the fat tissue, and it suppresses these enzymes in the fat tissue that break the fat down into molecules called fatty acids that could slip out of the fat cell and then be circulated around the body and used for fuel. And then as your insulin levels start coming down after the meals, your blood sugar is under control and you're metabolizing these carbohydrates, insulin levels drop. And as they drop, the fat begins to be released from the fat cells and oxidized, burned for fuel in the muscle cells. So when your body's working properly, you store fat immediately upon eating. And then after you've burned through the carbohydrates in your diet, you release that fat and start to burn that. And after your fat gets down to some certain level, your body prompts you to eat again. And then you repeat this cycle. And all day long, you store calories as fat. As you eat more than you expend. Yeah. And all night long, if your body's working properly, you burn the fat that you've stored during the day. And in an ideal, an organism that's working correctly, whether it's a human or a rat, this all balances out from day to day and week to week and month to month. You put on a little more fat in the winters because of, you know, you want to be able to get through periods without food and you need the warmth. And then summer comes, you burn through that fat. Anyway, if insulin stays elevated, that system begins to break down. And so the argument that researchers have made, and I made in my book, and I say isn't particularly new, is that all you have to do is raise insulin a little bit and keep it elevated a little bit longer than it should be, and you'll store calories, you know, store fat that you don't get around to oxidize.
Yeah.
And all you have to do is put 20 calories of fat, like one bite of food's worth of fat in your fat tissue every day. And over 20 years, that'll accumulate to 40 pounds of fat and obesity. And so the question then becomes, you know, how do you reverse this process? And as early as 1965, Rosalind Yalow and Salomon Burson, who won the – Yalow won the Nobel Prize for the technology that allowed researchers to measure hormones in the body. As early as 1965, they were saying the fundamental way to get fat out of fat tissue is to lower insulin. You want to mobilize fat and burn it, you have to lower insulin. And the way you do that is to get the carbohydrates out of the diet and replace them with fat.
Yeah. We had Dr. Robert Lustig on our show not so long ago. You've written about him, of course. He talks about makes this case that sugar really is the culprit in the obesity epidemic. And you've heard Lustig say this, and I wanted to get you to respond. He talks about places, for example, in developed countries. He mentions Japan and Italy as some that had low obesity rates, and they don't use a lot of sugar. That's one part. But they also have diets that are fairly high in refined carbohydrates, like rice, of course, and, you know, pasta and bread in Italy. Are you at odds with him on this particular point? I think he's saying that it's more complicated than just carbs. He's focusing on sugar. And what do you make of that? You know, you hear about the Mediterranean diet, you know, lots of pasta, lots of breads. How do you explain all of that?
Well, and that's Rob and I actually are pretty much in agreement. We know each other well, and you know, I think we're friends. The point he's making is a point I made in a New York Times Magazine article back in 2011. So we talked about obesity and diabetes and this condition called metabolic syndrome, which are all conditions that are the fundamental defect is called insulin resistance. So your body becomes your lean tissue, your muscle cells become resistant to the insulin you're secreting.
Yeah.
And so you have to secrete more insulin to deal with the same amount of carbohydrates, and now your insulin levels are elevated for a longer period of time, and you start getting into this problem I described. So the question is, what causes insulin resistance? And there's been a lot of evidence since the 1960s, at least maybe the 1950s, that sugar is the fundamental cause of insulin resistance, that sugar isn't like other carbohydrates. It's most starches and grains, they break down in your gut to glucose, and that's what raises your blood sugar. Mm-hmm. But sugar, so sucrose, the white stuff you put in your coffee, or high fructose corn syrup, which is in most, you know, sodas and but those are molecules of glucose and fructose.
Yeah.
And the fructose is not metabolized by every cell in the body. It's primarily metabolized in the liver. And this has been known for a long time. And like I said, since the 1960s, evidence was generated that fructose seemed to cause at least a lot of the symptoms of insulin resistance. In fact, if you want to cause insulin resistance in an animal model in a laboratory rat, the easiest way to do it is to feed it a high-sugar diet. So the idea is you add sugars to a population, and now they become insulin resistant, and now the other carbohydrates become problematic. And the more easily digestible they are, maybe the more grain they have, the more of a problem they are. So in that, I agree with Rob that the fundamental to the first trigger of these problems, if you don't have sugar in a diet, you have populations like most of Southeast Asia pre-1970s where they had high-carb diets. They're lean. You don't see diabetes. Then you add sugar to the diet. And then you have Southeast Asian populations in 2013 where obesity rates are increasing, diabetes rates are skyrocketing, and metabolic syndrome is rampant. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if the science is right, their heart disease rates are going to be going up as well. And so that's kind of the combination. It's the sugar that makes the other carbohydrates problematic. Now, where I differ from Rob a little bit is – what do you do about it? So I don't think it's enough to just get the sugar out of the diet, and I don't think he does either. I'm pretty sure he doesn't anymore. So the first step is to get people off sugars. But then in order to cure the sort of metabolic derangement that has set in, then you have to probably remove some to most to all of the other carbohydrates depending on how bad this derangement is, how severe their obesity and diabetes are. And you end up with something, you know, with the low-carbohydrate, high-fat diet. And I think Rob, because he was raised in a more traditional medical environment than I am, has a harder time embracing the idea that that diet could be healthy.
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Let's take a few calls. Mark is with us in Salt Lake City. Mark, welcome.
Hi. It's a pleasure to be on the air, and I really enjoy this topic because it's understated how little people understand about this topic. But my question really comes down to there are some low-carb, high-fat diets such as the Atkins that was popularized several years ago, although it's been around since the early 70s. And my mom, she's the only reason I know about this diet. After being on it for a long period of time, when she did consume carbohydrates, like say around a holiday or something, she found that she would gain weight disproportional to the amount of simple sugars, especially, that she would consume. So my question comes down to, does this type of limiting, can it set someone up to, after experiencing tremendous weight loss, to gain weight disproportionately?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. On one level, the answer is definitely yes, because when you go back to eating carbohydrates, you're liable to – there's this concept of water weight, which I won't get into the details, but you're liable to gain, you know, 5 or 8 or 10 pounds just from water weight. That comes with the carbohydrate-rich diet. But the argument I'm making, and it's is the fundamental cause of obesity. So you can break down obesity, I'm saying, is not an energy balance issue. It's a hormonal defect. And it's triggered by the carbohydrate content of the diet. So some of us cannot tolerate the carbohydrate-rich diet that we consume in modern America. And these carbohydrates are always going to be problematic. So it's like you would never quit smoking and say, now that I've gotten my lung cancer risk down to that of a non-smoker, I can go back to smoking. But that's what people tend to do in diets. They think, now that I've gotten my weight under control, I can go back to eating the way I used to. And the argument that I'm making and others make is that the carbohydrates are, for those of us who are predisposed to put on fat, we just can't eat these foods. And it's pretty much that simple. I used to be a smoker. I don't smoke. Because I know it's bad for me, and I know if I eat these foods. The question would be with cases like your mother is, well, she might seem to gain weight very quickly after a carbohydrate-rich meal over the holidays. Does it stay on and does it continue when she gets rid of the carbohydrates after the holidays? Because for many people, just understanding that the – you know, what's really going on, how their bodies work and what the carbohydrates do, they say, okay, if I fall off the wagon, just as if I was a smoker or an alcoholic who had a drink, I know that, you know, when the binge is over, I go back to being on the wagon and the problem will go away. But it's still a kind of lifelong fate. There's nothing, I talk in the book about how there's nothing fair about it, that somebody can not be able to eat foods that their sister can eat effortlessly and be thin. But that's just the cards that nature dealt us, and we have to live with them.
Yeah. This is an important point in the book. I mean, you write about the fact that there are these genetic variations you have to take into account, and there's no one-size-fits-all prescription for this. I mean, some, just as you say, may have to be really diligent. Others can be moderate in their approach. But I think the point is to kind of get to know your body and how it reacts to certain foods, I guess.
Well, and that's interesting because, you know, I would have probably made a lot more leeway with this argument if I had left Robert Atkins out of it, because he was such a polarizing figure. But I always believe in giving credit where credit is due, perhaps even to my own detriment. But one of the things Atkins did when he pioneered when he pioneered his version of this diet, which he acknowledged was, you know, 150 years old already.
Right.
As he said, here's one way to do this thing. Get rid of all carbohydrates. You remember, you want to minimize insulin levels. And if you don't actually know, there's a level, a threshold above which your body is going to hold, your fat cells are going to hold on to fat. And you want to get below that threshold, but you don't know what that threshold is. Mm-hmm. So you want to get insulin as low as possible. So you give up virtually all carbohydrates. It's what he called the induction phase.
Yeah.
And you replace with fat. And then once you're losing weight, you can start adding carbohydrates back to see what your body can tolerate. Another way to look at it is you could get down to a weight that you're comfortable with. And say over 4 or 6 months, maybe you lose 30, 40, 50 pounds. And now you're at a weight you like. And now you could say, gee, I haven't had an ice cream cone for 6 months. I really miss it. Let me see what that does to my body. Can I tolerate an ice cream cone? Or if I have one a week, will my weight go up disproportionately?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of self-experimentation involved with finding out what your body can tolerate or what might trigger fat accumulation in your body, almost independent of this concept of overeating. But, you know, again, fundamentally, the argument is that this is all triggered to a great, you know, by this carbohydrate-rich refined grains and sugars in our diet. And so the fundamental step is getting rid of those. And I would argue that virtually every diet that works, maybe every diet that works gets rid of those. The very low-fat diet that Dr. Dean Ornish here in San Francisco proposes also restricts refined grains and sugars because they stimulate insulin secretion. The South Beach diet restricts refined grains and sugars. The Mediterranean diet is a low-sugar, low white bread diet. You could think of it like that. The Zone, Protein Power, virtually all of them don't allow their subjects, the people who are on them, to eat refined grains and sugars. And I would say that's probably the fundamental reason those diets are working.
Gary Taubes is with us. His latest book is called Why We Get Fat and What to Do About It. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Gary Taubes. We're talking about one of his books. He's got a number on this subject, Why We Get Fat and What to Do About It. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Richard is with us in Orem, Utah. Richard, welcome.
Thank you.
Sure.
I've long believed that I'm descended from a long list of European famine survivors, and my ancestors may not have been fat because they had such active lifestyles, having to farm or work hard and so on. So but with our sedentary lifestyles these days and with those genetic predispositions, some of us can gain weight despite whatever we do, where my best buddy in high school, he could eat anything he wanted and he never gained weight.
Well, put aside, Gary Taubes, put aside the activity part, because I know you're going to challenge that question. but let's talk about the genetic component, because you do write about this, how much being overweight, the genetic component of fatness, this is something you do write about. Say something about that genetic part.
Well, we've known since the 1920s, 1930s, that obesity has a huge genetic component, that body type runs in families. You know, if you think about it, identical twins don't just have the same faces. They have the same body types. It tells you that it's genetic. The question is, what are the genes responding to? And then as our caller suggested, as a descendant of European famine victims, and I thought a lot of us are, there are what are called epigenetic or intrauterine effects that get transmitted. So if the mother is going through a famine when she's pregnant with you, or if she's gaining a lot of weight and is or gestationally diabetic or has diabetes or obese when she gets pregnant, you are going to grow up, you're going to evolve in the womb in a different fetal environment than would a child of a lean, healthy woman. And these changes that happen in the womb, these epigenetic changes, also are going to have a large effect on how you tolerate the food environment you see when you come out and grow up. And again, the argument I'm making, and this is probably oversimplified, is most of those changes probably have to do with insulin signaling, both the changes that are seen in an underfed fetus and the changes that are seen in what we could call an overfed fetus, and how the pancreas and the insulin signaling system responds to the food available.
Yeah.
So I think these are key factors that, again, get lost as soon as we decide that somehow it's just about how much we eat and exercise.
Well, let's get back to the exercise question that Richard raised. And Richard, thanks very much for the call. I mean, as you point this out in the book, there are lots of very good reasons to be physically active, but weight loss does not appear to be one of them.
Now, this is something that the research has always been pretty definitive. If you do an experiment and you get half your subjects to exercise and the other half to diet, actually what they usually do is diet plus exercise versus diet, because they figure the people on the exercise program are going to diet anyway, whether they tell them to or not. And you don't see any effect. And the American College of Sports Medicine and the American Heart Association pointed this out in 2007. They had physical activity guidelines that they jointly published, and they said there are a lot of good reasons to exercise, but there's just the data supporting this idea that increasing energy expenditure will lead to weight loss just isn't there. It's never been there. And there's an easy way to think about this, which is there used to be this concept that exercise and that physical activity worked up an appetite.
Yeah.
It makes you hungry. And if I invited you over to my house for dinner tonight and I said, look, I've got the six best chefs in Salt Lake City cooking a feast, the likes of which you've never seen in your life, and I want you to – there's going to be course after course after course of scrumptious, delicious food. Come hungry. Bring your appetite. I'm sure one of the two things you would do during the day to make sure that happened is probably exercise more. You might even say, hey, Gary lives 5 miles from where I work. I'm going to walk to his house because I'm going to build up an appetite. And all this has been thrown away in the confusion over what causes obesity. And when we lost our way in the 1950s, one of the things that got thrown out was just a simple concept that physical activity makes us hungry. That's what it does. Our body gives up calories. Our fat tissue gives up calories for fuel. And then our body tries to replete them afterward.
801-585-WEST. Again, the number two. Join the conversation. Back to the phones. Joan is with us in Salt Lake. Joan, hi.
Hi. My diet is very big on salads and vegetables with a protein side dish. This was after I managed to lose 40 pounds after I gradually gained it when I stopped running. I'm just wondering about the carb content of things like vegetables and salads.
And that's an interesting question. I'm arguing, and my books argue, that what you want to stay away from are the refined grains, sugars, and starches. And so salads, green leafy vegetables actually have a very low digestible carbohydrate content. And so most of us, many of us, when we go on these diets, you give up, like you go to lunch and you say, you know, instead of having a hamburger and a bun and French fries, let me just have the hamburger meat and a green salad. That's always been sort of the classic diet lunch until hamburgers became deadly. But there are people with – if the weight problem is severe enough, the question you'd have to ask is if you're getting most of your calories from even salads and green vegetables, it means you're getting most of your diet still from carbohydrates or slow-acting carbs or slow carbs, as one writer calls them. And so they're not going to stimulate a lot of insulin secretion. But if you're very sensitive to them, they could still be slightly problematic. And this is where that self-experimentation comes in. You know, people are afraid, and we've heard so much about the dangers of fat in the diet and the benefits of green vegetables that we think the best way to do this, I'll give up the starches and I'll eat the vegetables and lean meat. And, you know, again, if you just look at the physiology, that's not necessarily true. And what we need are much better studies to determine how this should be played out for different types of people and different individuals and the population at large.
Yeah. Are we getting those studies? Are we getting close to doing those studies?
Well, again, a lot of these arguments that I'm making are still – I mean, to call them controversial is to be kind. You know, much of the last 10 years in nutrition research community, we just kind of wish I would go away.
It's true.
And, you know, the physicians who use these diets and wrote about these diets as kind of de facto quacks, they're definitely being embraced. Now we're making an enormous amount of progress, but it's still unclear whether the federal government, the National Institutes of Health, that's sort of the natural owner of these kinds of research projects, is willing to accept this idea that what makes us fat is not the total quantity or balance of calories in the diet, but the macronutrients, and that needs much better research. And in fact, with a colleague in San Diego, Dr. Peter Attia, I started a not-for-profit called the Nutrition Science Initiative to actually raise money to fund the kind of research and the quality of research that we think is necessary. And Dr. Attia is the president. We have support from the Laura and John Arnold Foundation in Houston, Texas, and they've actually given us now $40 million for the first three research projects, all being done by extremely good skeptical obesity research, the nutritionists at some of the best, you know, most influential institutions in the country. Mm. And so we're trying to fill the void and then hoping that at some point the results from these studies will catalyze the NIH to get back into this game.
Let me ask you this finally. We've got less than a minute here. But it's interesting. One of the things you wrote before you started into all of this in terms of talking about bad science was cold fusion. And I'm wondering if the lesson of bad science, bad nutritional science, bad physical, you know, science, has that given you any insights as to why these kinds of myths persist? Is this a cultural reaction? Do you think you understand it now?
I'm still mystified, but cold fusion was definitely my primary learning experience.
Yeah.
It's hard to imagine how easy it is to get the wrong answer in science. It's just doing science correctly, learning something new about the universe, is probably the most difficult thing there is out there. And researchers, physicians, public health people, they come in, they think it's easy, and they can do a study and believe what their study tells them, and the lesson of episodes like cold fusion is that's just not true. And I think the physics community understands this very well. But in medicine and public health, this message has been lost, that really meticulous, rigorous research is needed, and skepticism, skepticism, skepticism.
Gary Taubes is the author of a number of books, including Good Calories, Bad Calories, and Why We Get Fat and What to Do About It. Joined us today from the studios of Youth Radio in Oakland, California. Gary Taubes, thanks very much.
Well, thank you.
Radio West, production of KUER News. Special thanks today to Robin Gee and James Rowland at Youth Radio. The program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.